Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. My guest today is Matt Sheehan, joining me back on the show. And we talked about June movies a while ago.
Yes, it's been quite a while.
And we were just going to talk about all the summer movies, but we got carried away because there was just so much in 1 month. There's so much in 1 week. I mean, you can kind of just kind of go on and on.
Yeah, the summer is quite loaded. Plenty that already has come out, and August has enough coming out on its own as well. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
But now it's been about a week or so after The Dark Knight Rises has been released. And I don't know. I mean, there are some people that just like to give away everything, like in a review. They like to give away all the spoilers, everything. And we're not going to do that. But we're going to discuss the film because the film is very much worth discussing. And there's so many. I mean, one thing I love about Nolan is that he has the perfect taste of actor for every role. Just no matter if it's huge or just like a few lines, he knows exactly who to cast.
Yes, yeah.
And so throughout the show, I'm just going to be throwing out some recommendations of other titles these actors have been in that are a little smaller, a little more indie. That's kind of like my indie bent on this episode, and well worth seeing any way you can. Even Netflix, you know, works great. So
yes.
But, okay, so what are your just general thoughts on this thing? Because we haven't really talked too much in broad strokes about this.
Well, let's just say I think it should be evidence enough that they had two press screenings and 2 days, and I went to both because I wanted to see how it carries over in that second time, and it's phenomenal. It just, the pacing and everything, and it does not feel like the 2 hours and 45 minutes of running time that it is. It does not. Afterwards, that first time I'm looking, going at my watch, going, it's really? That was almost 3 hours long. Did not feel like that. And I think that's a testament to how Nolan does as a filmmaker and how well he does everything. And he does everything with the, focusing on characters so much.
Mm-hmm.
And as we sort of touched on, I believe, last time I was on, he deals with a lot with dual identities.
Mm-hmm.
And with that dual identities, you know, it's focusing on that main character. He focuses in on Bruce Wayne in this one a lot.
Well, that's why I think it comes full circle, because I feel like this is the only Batman saga franchise, you know, film versions that really make Bruce Wayne the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that got a bit lost in Dark Knight because the Joker was such a powerful presence.
Yes.
But I really feel like it comes full circle here where Bruce Wayne really is the main character. And some people are like, well, there's not enough Batman in this. I feel like there is. I feel like he's ever present within Bruce Wayne. And I feel like it's just a testament to the complexity of Christian Bale's performance, which I know I admired in the past films, but it wasn't really until this one where I really enjoyed the multifaceted nature of Bruce Wayne, which you haven't really seen before. I mean, you've seen hints of it here and there, but I think he really is the most complex.
Well, yeah, and I think with the focusing in on him, how he's broken as a human being right at the start, and you get that feeling where you can connect with him about how you feel about him, and focusing in on that first,
mm-hmm.
it makes the sort of, you know, it's the return of Batman all the more special and on all the more thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
It is that it's almost used as a suspense tool. It's used as just so much that it works so well.
Yeah.
Like that.
And I'm not even sure if they mention in the film that this takes place 8 years after the events of the Dark. They do mention that. Okay. So you can tell that time has passed and that mm-hmm. he has become this kind of broken, sheltered. People are talking about him like Howard Hughes. He's just kind of like hiding in his
8-inch fingernails and whatever.
That's right.
Mason jars.
That's right. And I feel you can sense that in Christian Bale's performance. And I was reminded of some of the smaller films he's done, like The Machinist
mm-hmm.
and Rescue Dawn, where in The Machinist he looks like a human skeleton. And so mm-hmm. when Christopher Nolan first approached him, you know, for the role of Batman, I mean, he was like, oh, how am I going to cast this guy? He's just like a little twig. But mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know exactly who, you know, Christian Bale's personal trainer is or who his dietitian is. I don't know exactly what it is. But I mean, he beefed up so fast to play Bruce Wayne. It was pretty.
I think right before Batman Begins, I think I remember reading somewhere that they, you know, Warner Brothers and everybody was like, okay, we're picking Nolan to direct. And, you know, they started filling in the cast and they picked Christian Bale. And then the first images of The Machinist come out of him, you know, skin and bones, looking like mm-hmm. some, you know, terrible prison camp prisoner.
Yeah, it was like the Robert De Niro in Raging Bull in reverse, in a sense, where he's just kind of like starving himself. Some people said for a stunt, but I thought it was a very affecting portrayal.
I think I remember reading he ate like one can of tuna and water throughout an entire day. That's how he got that way. Yeah. But what's funny is that then when, you know, Warner Brothers is all worried because they got this big franchise, they want to reboot and do right and well, and then he shows up jacked and he's got too much muscle, supposedly. He had like 20 to 30 pounds more muscle than needed, so he actually had to scale it back. But that, again, is testament to him being dedicated to this work and believing in the vision for these movies.
Mm-hmm. And I saw a little bit, I don't know how much, if there was much of a physical transformation in this film, but I felt like at the beginning he looks a bit gaunt. It looks like the gaunt sort of
Bale. Yeah, it seemed to carry over from The Fighter. You could tell, you could see that, because The Fighter, he didn't really lose a ton of weight. You could see that it's like his outer shell, the outer protective covering of him has just been knocked away. He's not completely, you know, skin and bones like in The Machinist, but he still sensed that there's something missing. Something's been sliced off of him, like part of it's almost like part of his soul, and that's, again, testament to his Oscar winning performance in that.
Yeah, and this really is the story of Bruce Wayne. He really is the central focus. We're looking at his arc, his final, you know, sort of lesson that he has to learn in the film, not to give away too much. But I thought that made sense dramatically as well when you look at the villains, because the villains in this film are effective, but I don't feel like none of them are scenery chewers like the Joker. I mean, the Joker really did dominate The Dark Knight, and I feel like in this one, the villains are kind of on the sidelines in the same way that that they were in Batman Begins. And I feel like, in a sense, Bane, you know, played by Tom Hardy, who we always thought, we were talking about this last night, that we thought, well, Christopher Nolan must have seen his amazing performance in Bronson, the Nicholas Winding Refn film about a prisoner who likens himself after Charles Bronson. And it's an amazing, weird, almost kabuki performance at times when you're going inside Bronson's head. And, I mean, that's like the ultimate showcase, but it wasn't that film at all that Nolan saw.
Yeah, the funny part is that he shows up on set and he goes, oh, thanks for casting me because of Bronson. He goes, I've never seen Bronson. I cast you because of Rock and Rolla. You know,
Ritchie, I can't remember his role in Rock and Roll.
I can't even remember that movie. That's, you know, it's as I mentioned last night, is I don't even remember it because it was, I just remember so many people being upset that the Chicago International Film Festival, that was the big surprise movie, and it's one of those things going, really?
Yeah.
Like, I think that year was, I can't remember what else people were pitching around as ideas for that. I know some people like to try and guess and try and figure out, look at the lineup and then say, oh, they like to do this or like to do that. But you go with a Guy Ritchie movie and you go, really?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I mean, he has all, it's because of, you know, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. I mean, that's basically his calling card. Those for the Snatch, you know, those are his, you know, calling cards. But this was a very minor work before the Sherlock Holmes franchise, you know.
Should also mention, too, that he was also in Matthew Vaughn's first movie, Layer Cake. He had a small part.
Tom Hardy?
Yes. Yeah. And I know Entertainment Weekly did a feature piece a couple weeks ago, or about a month ago, about underrated movies. And on the cover,
oh, that's right, Layer Cake. Yeah.
And on the cover was Layer Cake, and then they also highlighted Rescue Dawn with Christian Bale too. Two movies that I love. I love Layer Cake. I'm a big Daniel Craig fan. And then obviously with Christian Bale, and Rescue Dawn was something that I sort of hold close, near and dear, because that was my first press interview I got to do with Steve Zahn and that. And that was my, you know, that was my very first one, and I loved it, and I had so much fun doing it. So I that's that film, not just because it's very well made, and it's a great movie, but the fact that personally, professionally, that's close.
And that's the best performance of Steve Zahn's career. I think his quintessential performance is That Thing You Do. I mean, I think that's just his classic comic persona. But he got to go really dark in that. And just a little, just going off on Rescue Dawn for a second, I mean, that's Werner Herzog's, you know, fictionalized scripted version of a documentary he did called Little Dieter Needs to Fly, which is even more spectacular, I think, just in terms of the, you know, the drama. But they're both very good films.
I mean, look at that cast too in Rescue Dawn too. Mm-hmm. You got Christian Bale, Steve Zahn, Jeremy Davies is in it too.
That's right.
And he's it's almost like you sense that Christian Bale looked at Jeremy Davies, because you want to talk about skin and bone, and him are looking very gone. Christian Bale probably looked at him going, "Whoa, scale back a little bit." He didn't go that much, but you know, you there's so much great stuff. I remember sitting in the critics screening room watching that, just being dazzled by it.
Mm-hmm.
The visuals and the story, and that's sold again by characters, and that's, you know, sold by Christian Bale's performance and all the rest of the supporting cast performance. And I think that's certainly, you know, that's why, you know, he was cast as Batman. You know, that's why he was cast as Bruce Wayne. And I think what's testament to a lot of these comic book movies and superhero movies with the dual identities, like your Spider-Mans and all that, is that you need to sell that particular actor that you cast as a good original version. Like, you needed to sell Tobey Maguire or Andrew Garfield as the Peter Parker.
Mm-hmm,
you needed to sell that as him in order to really fully grasp that turn. And I think with Christian Bale, you look at Bruce Wayne, he's a very tortured, tormented soul. You know, internally, he internalizes a lot of it. And to be able to channel everything out on, you know, sort of this vigilante justice and still be considered an outcast, despite the fact that when he is that normal Bruce Wayne, he feels very alone because of that. He's got this decadent lifestyle, and he's got to show off to really truly feel like he belongs in Gotham City. But then when he goes and actually does something that can be considered good for the city, he's labeled an outcast or, you know, a vigilante or a thug. But again, that goes back to believing Christian Bale as a Bruce Wayne first. That, I think, is first and foremost what you need to do in a lot of these superhero and dual identity movies with alter egos.
Absolutely. And I think he, I mean, if we want to talk about his arc in this film, if we want to talk about, you know, the Bruce Wayne arc, I mean, Nolan is very careful to not make any overt political statements. And he says that it's not a left or right leaning film. But I feel like, I mean, and the character of Bane, just going back to him as well, I mean, I think Hardy does as good as he could, you know, with a huge mask over his face and doing some kind of, you know, Darth Vader kind of evil Cockney thing going on there. I wasn't affected by him the way I was affected by, you know, the Joker or even, you know, the Scarecrow. I think he's more of a force than a character. He's more symbolic of this just the discontent, you know, within the society. Although he's basically, you know, like an anarchist. He's basically just wanting to tear down society and, you know, just using people's, you know, economic, you know, woes and, you know, cultural woes, you know, to his advantage. I mean, that's what he's doing. But he has, unlike the Joker, he does have a certain goal to accomplish, you know, in that sense. And I thought that it was powerful, but it wasn't, I mean, I think he's a stronger symbol than a character.
Yeah, I mean, granted, anything that follows the Joker as portrayed by Heath Ledger, it's going to be hard to top anyways. I mean, for several different reasons. It's an Oscar-winning performance. It is a great performance. It's Heath Ledger's, you know, final completed performance. So there's so much that is right, and it's like, how do you not, you know, top that? How do you even try and top that? Do you even try to attempt to do better than that? And I think Nolan made a very good decision, too, is that, you know, there is no mention of the Joker in this. Mm-hmm. You know, it focuses in on, and like how he said how Dark Knight was, it was more about Harvey Dent than it was the Joker. Mm-hmm. And this specifically is. It focuses in on, look at this Harvey Dent, you know, not to give anything away about what happened in the previous movie, but how that ends, you know, everything now in Gotham is based on a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trying to, you know, bring that, you know, bring an honest approach to it. And there's so much in this that, you know, it's trying to, you know, we did this Gotham safer based on this, but now you kind of want, you sense things are better, but I really don't feel good about myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Gary Oldman's, you know, Commissioner Gordon, he wants to, you know, Batman wants to do right by this. You know, Bruce Wayne wants to do right by this. And there's plenty of other people that want to see this honest and truth really come to light. Mm-hmm. So then you can truly appreciate that, yeah, of what happened to Harvey Dent / Two-Face, but we still wanted the best for the entire city as a whole, much like he did.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, and I think that if you're looking at this in any sort of political terms, I don't know. I mean, it's all up for grabs. I mean, he makes it ambiguous enough where you can really kind of dissect it. Although it is funny when you have someone like Rush Limbaugh say, this is all supposed to, you know, all the Bane capital stuff. Well, clearly Bane is, you know, even though Bane's a character that's existed for so many years, you know, in the comics, I mean, it's clearly, I mean, and the script was written before Occupy Wall Street happened, you know, and it was just totally coincidental that they're filming these Occupy Gotham scenes right alongside Wall Street. But I feel like the political message is not as obvious as it may seem. And I feel like it's more about Bruce Wayne's own personal transition and his own. I feel it's a balance of messages, I think.
Well, it's also, I think it can show that there's a certain fragility to democracy and capitalism. That it can easily be broken. I mean, there's, you know, you talk about all these people, you know, looting Wall Street. Well, there's a literal assault on, you know, on a stock exchange in this, and it's a great sequence. But, yeah, it's there's no specific political thing. And I know Nolan sits there, and I know, I believe it was in one interview I read, people asked about it, you know, especially with the post 9/11, you know, like an individual. You know, ravaged by catastrophe and tragedy and all this. And they listed a couple different pointers about how, you know, terrorism and whatnot. And Christopher Nolan's response was, well, does that really make the movie political?
I know.
Does it really make anything political?
Which is so great because everything has to be politicized these days. Everything in the national conversation has to be politicized. And what's great about art is that you can talk about these issues and not have to worry about what side of the fence am I on. It really does provoke very universal fears and paranoias about, you know, exactly, you know, the debates of, you know, the moment. And that's what's so exciting about his work. And the character of Catwoman in this film, who's never named Catwoman, just kind of like how I don't think Two-Face is named Two-Face.
But that again, is testament to also, like, to lead into it, is they're focusing in on the character of Selina Kyle, not alter ego. And that works well.
It works very well. Anne Hathaway is wonderful. I thought she was really wonderful in the movie. I thought I've never really seen her take on this kind of character before, where she's just so she has an air about her that's just so confident, and she can put on like the little girl, you know, scared look, you know, when necessary. Yeah. But no, there's never a moment where she's unsure of herself.
Yeah, there's a lot of I think you just said the confidence part. There's a certain confidence in that, and there's a confidence in herself. There's a confidence in the script, and there's a confidence in Nolan's vision. So she was sold on. And you know that the second she got contacted about this, she was jumping for joy and wanted to. You sense that.
Yeah.
You sense she said, oh, with Christopher Nolan, I'll do that. When, where, just sign me up. But, there's a certain, you know, confidence. There's a certain cat, you know, no pun intended, but there's a cattiness to her character, the way she talks.
Yes. And there's a cattiness with her relationship to the audience, because you know when she's, you know, duping someone, and that's great. I mean, you're compliant with her. You know.
And her characters, you know, like the way I discussed with Heath Ledger's Joker is I really can't compare it to Nicholson's, because they're essentially, they're 180 degree turns of the same character. They're both great performances. Nicholson's is wonderful.
And they're different types of performances. They're different approaches. It's totally,
They're two sides to the same coin. That's what they are. You know, and I think that's the same thing. I can't compare, you know, Anne Hathaway to Michelle Pfeiffer, because I like Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman for several reasons. You know, some might be obvious than others. And I love both Burton's films. I think Batman Returns does get a bad rap. I think there's a lot of great stuff in that.
I think there's good stuff. I think it is flawed. I think there are certain characters that don't really pay off. I feel like the most effective stuff in Batman Returns is the stuff with Catwoman. I think Pfeiffer's whole performance. And what I love is that the promise of the somewhat of a relationship or somewhat of a connection between her and Batman in Batman Returns and the Burton film really pays off in this film, as far as how it really gets to link the similarities between them in very intriguing ways. When they have one of my favorite scenes in The Dark Knight Rises is a scene that's kind of almost right out of Batman Returns, when they're at this costume party. They're at this dance. And Hathaway has this amazing monologue where she's almost, I mean, people are interpreting it as like the rally cry of the 99%, where it's like, you know, you guys think this is going to last, you know, you never, how could you ever think you could live so large and leave so little for the rest of us? And I feel like I mean, and again, people will interpret that one way, but then there's several things in the film that contradict that statement. Mm-hmm. But I feel like overall, Bruce Wayne listens to that, and he really, I think that becomes part of his, I think he's somewhat seduced by her philosophy, or I, mm-hmm. I think it piques his interest. Like, he isn't just turned off from her. He actually, he thinks there's more to her. And I feel like it's this philosophy, this call for philanthropy ends up being one of the overriding themes in the film. And I guess it's something that Nolan thinks can be a universal enough message that anyone can kind of embrace that.
And that's something that you brought up that reminds me of one point, is that the, there's this sense of, once Fox News gets a hold of this, you wonder what they're going to say, because there's one line that Alfred says, that Gotham needs Bruce Wayne. And the first thought that popped in my head is, because at this point, Bruce Wayne's sitting there wanting to, he's wondering why, the Wayne Foundation isn't funding certain things to help with, the lower middle class and all this, with inner city and whatnot. And it started to make me think. It goes, well, Bruce Wayne is the liberal versus Batman, the conservative, the very, individualistic justice, exact justice, so to speak, of being able to smash somebody's head in and defend, their own property and their own country, very xenophobic in a way. But being able to do that and then answer questions later.
That's interesting. So in that interpretation, the dual character, it's almost like Wayne the liberal and Batman the conservative as far as... That's so interesting.
And you kind of wonder, but that of course was only in the... thankfully they didn't sit there and focus too much. So that was just something I picked up and I jotted down on my notes saying, has Fox News reviewed this yet? And what will they say? And nothing has been said yet about it, but it'd be interesting to see what happens. And then also, to be honest, I would love to see The Daily Show cover something about with the whole Bane versus Bane capital of the Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, that's just absurd. I mean, that's just absurdity.
I mean, I would love to see that and see what they say about it. But again, there's really no, you want to say it's non-political, but then you also want to say it's apolitical. It covers both grounds, and then it covers no grounds.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a lot of stuff for both, and there's a lot of where it has nothing to do with either side.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that travels back, we'll go full circle here, it travels back to being Nolan a great filmmaker.
Absolutely, and that's why I love what Catwoman says to him, it does become a bit of the message, or a bit of, something where when we've reached such desperate times, people have to, chip in a little bit. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's kind of what it is. And I feel like, Bruce Wayne has to have this journey where he gets beaten down so badly that that he rediscovers the will to fight back and just kind of completely give up the sort of comfort of his, economic surroundings, and really it's when all of that's stripped from him, that's when he finds the will.
Well, there's one line there's one line that's said in it by a character where they're talking about throwing money at some sort of environmental project or whatever, I think it's like Save the World Project or whatever, and it says you have to invest to restore balance to the world. And again, that's another point of what will conservatives and the right say about that. In regards to the current political situation. And yes, it's a very, his movies have always been based in a certain sense of reality.
Yes, absolutely. It's echoing very much. He allows the real world to inspire, his vision of this world and everything. And Anne Hathaway, again, just really quick on her. I mean, I thought that she, I thought she gave an Oscar caliber performance in Rachel Getting Married, the Jonathan Demme film. I thought that was that really was the first film where I saw what she was capable of as an actress. And I think in this film, it really is even just furthering my just admiration of her versatility, I guess. I mean, she reminds me of Audrey Hepburn at times in this film.
A
kick-ass Audrey Hepburn, though.
she's also, I was watching the other night, believe it or not, was Get Smart.
Oh, yeah.
She's got great comic timing, too. When she hosted the Oscars back with James Franco, I wasn't as harsh on that show as everybody else was. I think, they were trying to, the writers were trying to fit something with James Franco's personality a little bit more. But I think Anne Hathaway was, and then the previous year, year or two before that, when Hugh Jackman hosted and he had Anne Hathaway come up and they did that song and dance thing. it does show, again, her versatility. She's got great comic timing. She can act, you know, great. And I think another point, too, with her casting here is that all of that combined with, I'm not trying to be superficial about it, but her looks, too. She's got these big, you know, doughy Bambi eyes that almost have this cat-like quality to it, where you sit there and you can imagine just a cat looking up. But, of course, it's not towards that, it doesn't lean towards that campiness like Tim Burton did, where he made Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman be almost become a cat, you know, cleaning themselves and sort of, you know, these little campy jokes.
And we don't really even need to know why she dresses up as a cat. I mean, there's really no attempt in this film. I mean, whereas with Batman Returns, it's very much about why she transforms into this. And in this, that's just kind of accepted right off the bat, which I thought was interesting. Yeah. And then another actor who I could see in just about anything is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who has a role in this film that I think this could have been the blandest character in the movie. It could have been the character where you're kind of like, oh, here's, you know, the do-gooder. Here's the cop who's just compassionate and he believes in Batman and blah, 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 blah. But he brings so much conviction and so much anger, I thought, to this character. Like, I think he really embodies the public's rage at just this system that's so broken. And I was just as much on pins and needles for his character's, you know, fate as Batman's in the film. I thought he was tremendous.
Yeah, he's certainly come a long way since Third Rock from the Sun, for sure. And yeah,
I'm a defender of this guy. I thought he showed potential in Angels in the Outfield, which is just the silliest Disney remake. But there's a scene where, like, his father abandons him in some... I mean, because I saw him when I was a kid.
I remember.
Scene where his father abandons him. And his acting is terrific. He's just a natural actor.
Yeah, and he's, you know, even that opening part in Halloween H2O, too. And then and then he sort of disappeared, and then he does The Lookout.
Because he does a series of these independent films, starting with Mysterious Skin, I think was his breakout, which was just an incredible portrait of this guy who's just on the fringes of life. It's just an amazing performance. And then The Lookout, and then Brick, and then
even 500
Days of Summer. I mean, he's shown again just such an amazing range of versatility.
Yeah, and you were talking about how he's very angry, but he's in Dark Knight Rises, but he can actually. You can tell that because there's certain parts in this movie that Bruce Wayne has to find help in more ways than one. You know, he's normally had to focus on a couple in the previous two movies, but now he has to sit there and he needs to look elsewhere. That, you know, he's not getting all the answers. There's something different about this, and part of it is learning from this John Blake character that he, you know. You know, he was a he grew up in an orphanage, and you know, he knew how to deal with, you know, this whole, you know, I think there's that great, you know, that great dialogue with Christian Bale where he's talking about having to look in the mirror and learn how to smile, and how he recognized, saying that I saw this face that you had, and I knew exactly, you know, that I recognized his face because it was the same one I practiced in the mirror several times before. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like he's trying to sit there. He's one of the teachers for Bruce Wayne. You never really realize it because he's young. I think at some point he's labeled a rookie cop, but he's still trying to learn, but he's still got a lot to teach too. And that's, again, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt has gone from, you know, he's been sitting there absorbing a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And now he's being able to be a good teacher, too, because of so many stuff. And, you know, he's got a Premium Rush movie, David Koepp's second directorial movie that's coming out in August. And that, you know, it's been pushed around, but I'm still very much looking forward to it. Because I like David Koepp's first directorial movie, Ghost World.
Ghost Town. Ghost World's good, too.
Zwigoff. Yeah. But, yeah, especially with him in Inception, he was great. There's so much that he's got going for him that I don't think
there's a more promising, exciting actor today. I mean, next to, you know, Ryan Gosling, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I guess they're both kind of on the same level.
And if you want to go on, like, the actresses part too, you got, like, just people like Jennifer Lawrence too, you know, rising fast. But, you know, he's certainly one that he's got the indie cred. He's got the child acting that, you know, he's certainly got good comic timing too, as shown by Third Rock from the Sun. But, yeah, he's certainly got the acting chops to go with
absolutely.
It,
absolutely. So I guess just at the end here, just general thoughts on this franchise as a whole. For me, I think that it's difficult to judge each chapter on its own because it really is such of a piece. And I think one of the great achievements of The Dark Knight Rises is that it really does now feel like one coherent story. And even if that wasn't what Nolan originally planned, he makes it work. He really makes it work in this film, and he goes back to clips from the first two films, and it really kind of gels thematically, dramatically. There were so many loose ends in The Dark Knight that I would have been so frustrated if those were just kind of like left hanging. And I feel like each of them, he really has them pay off in very intriguing ways. And the less that you are familiar with the comics, the more you'll be blown out of your seat by some of these twists that I didn't see coming. But I know that people, you know, who are familiar with the comics, they'll be pleased to see these references, I'm sure, to see that he includes them.
It certainly is a saga piece. It is certainly, it's Dark Knight was almost kind of like the way it ended. You had this sense of like after you first watched Empire Strikes Back.
Absolutely.
This sense of just, it's kind of a sour, bittersweet ending. You know there's more to it, and you know there's going to be some final resolution. And obviously, thankfully, as Nolan I know said in several things, he was hesitant in returning for a third one because, he goes, how many good third films are there? Mm-hmm. And I think this one is a great emotional payoff. There's a lot of emotion in this. There's a certain point towards the end where I, at that first screening, I started to tear up a little because Nolan had us emotionally invested in these characters. And again, bring back to my main, one of my main points is that that's because we focused in on the main character, the main main alter ego, not to the other one, the vigilante or the monster, as some people sometimes call it. So I think there's that emotional investment that is a huge payoff in this movie. And I think it really brings it full circle because there is a little bit more that if it ties into Batman Begins than I think Dark Knight, but again, it's that, like I said, full circle. It just brings everything and it wraps everything up perfectly. And I think it's just a fantastic movie. It certainly is one of the best of the year. And especially considering that this follows up the Avengers. You know, we've got two
totally different takes. And, and if this film doesn't make as much money as the Avengers, it makes complete sense because the Avengers was tailor-made for an all audience. I mean, you could have kids see this. You could see, I mean, the widest possible audience. This film is uncompromising as an adult picture. I mean, it's PG-13. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it's not like only 18 and above can see it, but it is that intense. It's that serious. It's that dramatic. It's not going for the easy slapstick laughs of the Avengers. I mean, this is what it is. And I people will accept it for what it is.
It's a dark, it's bleak. But the climax, the ending, everything is just like, it's just perfect.
It'll send you just skyrocketing out of the theater, wanting to see it again.
Yes, and I can certainly tell from personal experience so far that it does work. It's even better the second time around, and it's so great. And I couldn't be happier. I don't know if I'd consider it the best of the franchise because I sort of put it on the same thing as Dark Knight. But again, I think it's two completely different films.
Yeah, because I feel like I have to accept it as one piece. And Nolan has said in interviews he looked at the Lord of the Rings trilogy for inspiration. And it's the same way. It's like you cannot imagine now. I can't imagine Batman Begins the Dark Knight without The Dark Knight Rises now. It's just they're completely intertwined. And there's things that are set up in the earlier films that pay off here. Or it's just like, it's just one strand. It's just
there's
one
so much
thing.
Set up in, you know, it's like the first Batman Begins, you sense that there was something just like, we're just trying something new. Second one was something really concise and clear, and you sense that almost like halfway through filming that, they already had the plot and everything lined up for this one and how they were going to pay off everything. Because there's a lot of stuff that's set up in that second one that here is just wrapped up, everything's solved and tied together, and it just works so beautifully.
Yes, and if I have any overarching quibble on the franchise, it's just that Nolan is so audacious in how much story he packs into these films. I mean, just so much story per minute that I feel like some scenes feel a bit clipped, and it almost feels like the shorter version of a bigger film. So really, the biggest quibble is that it makes you hungry for more. I guess that's a good thing.
Yes.
But there are times where the scenes just feel like I could see a few more minutes here, a few more seconds there. It almost seems like you can imagine a bigger director's cut of the entire thing.
I don't know if, I mean, because he's been so successful with these films, I can't see, he's got a lot of power probably with Warner Brothers and the marketing department. I mean, I could see some big set come out. You just know that there's going to be some big gift set with limited edition, and it's numbered and little extras and whatever thrown in. But I can't imagine them.
I mean, just as the Lord of the Rings, you know, they have all the extended editions. And I don't know if he'll ever.
Also Warner Brothers, too. So.
Also Warner Brothers. And I don't know if he'll ever choose to do that. But I think especially, I mean, I guess The Dark Knight, you can look at that film. I think that's probably the best paced film. I think there's a lot of scenes that feel very complete. But I feel like in Batman Begins, the first half, and even The Dark Knight Rises, I guess, the first half. There, and even Inception, the first half. There are certain moments that just feel a bit clipped, a bit choppy. And but I don't know. It's such a complete experience that when you take it as a whole, it doesn't bother you as much.
And even though that this is everybody said this is the last one, and then Warner Brothers, I believe, is going to reboot it with somebody different, and that's all fine and whatever, you know, as long as it's not Joel Schumacher. But
exactly.
But I think it certainly makes you wonder, what is this guy going to do next? Mm-hmm. Because he did his independent film Following. Then he did Memento, which made him sort of a name. Then he did Insomnia was next. And then it became Batman Begins, and it was just, you know, Inception is so wonderful.
And then he fit in The Prestige
and Prestige,
Inception.
Too, I forgot. Yeah, but there's so much in.
But there's so much this guy can do, and I feel the same way at the end of this, where it's like, you know, Nolan served his time just as Batman served his time for Gotham, and I'm just grateful. That's basically how I feel at the end, where I'm grateful that he saw his story through.
Yes, his vision.
Just as Batman saw his career through.
It's a complete vision, and it's a complete story, and everything is just, like I said, wrapped up nicely, wonderfully. And again, I just can't wait to, you know, he's going to be taking a long vacation and he's going to take a break from all this after everything's done and dead. Then he's going to start wondering what he's going to do next. And I know there's been talk of maybe him doing a James Bond movie, which I would be thrilled head over heels with, but I know that he's probably just going to take a breather first and see what's out there, and just enjoy the fact that everything that he's done with this, you know, he himself was emotionally invested in this entire character
exactly.
franchise.
And that's why we are too. That's why we are too. Yeah. We're not detached whatsoever. So thank you so much for being on the show, Matt.
Love being here again.
So appreciate it. And for all of my recent reviews and interviews, you can check out HollywoodChicago.com. And for all of Matt Sheehan's reviews and interviews, check out HollywoodSnitch.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.